Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C., a host of the channel. Our guest today is Professor Iraj Bashiri, who will be talking about his new book, The History of the Civil War in Tajikistan, published this year, 2020, with Academic Studies Press. Iraj Bashiri is a leading scholar in Central Asian Studies and Iranian Studies, with a focus on Tajik-Iranian identity. He is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Minnesota, where he taught on a variety of topics, including the history of Afghanistan, Central Asia, Iran, with a specific focus on intellectual, religious, and political history. He has traveled extensively throughout Iran and Central Asia, with stints as a visiting scholar in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan. He has worked closely with the Tajik Division of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and has published extensively in the field of Persian studies. He has also authored a number of works focused specifically on Tajikistan, including the English translation of Maso's The History of a National Catastrophe, as well as his own works, including The Samanids and The Revival of the Civilization of the Iranian Peoples, as well as prominent Tajik figures of the 20th century. Iraj, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'd like to begin our discussion today on your new book by asking you a little bit about your career, your scholarly work, and specifically how you became interested in Tajikistan.
Okay, great. My early training is in English literature, and I changed from literature in the late 60s to general linguistics, and from there to Iranian linguistics. So that's my general background. But I have done extensive research in literature and also in history. And of course, it's the history part that we are dealing with. But in literature, I am a structural analyst in that I have my linguistic background and I have my literature background, which I apply to literature itself and in my historical investigations to more analytical and looking at issues long time to see how everything works and then make judgment. And that's what I've done in my career, I would say, because I teach courses on ancient Iran and I relate that to ancient Egypt, which usually nobody relates to, but is very, very pertinent because Iranian cosmology, mythology are pretty much Iranian. But when we get to history, Iranians ruled Egypt for 200 years. And therefore, there is a marked distinction there in the development of things when Egypt comes in. I wrote ancient Iran, cosmology, mythology, history in that relation. Then also I teach, a modern Iran course, which deals with post Samanid, Sasanian, meaning basically Islamic Iran. And I wrote Modern Iran, Caliphs, Kings, and Jurisprudence, that deals with the history of Iran after the Arab invasion up to the time of Ruhollah Khomeini. So it's a long history, as you can see. But the major element to them dealing with in all of this is looking for Iranian identity, and Tajik identity is a part of Iranian identity. And that's how I got involved, actually, in that. In the 16th century, the Iranians and Tajiks separated because Iranians chose Shiism, which Tajiks did not. They stayed Hanafi Sunni. And from then on, we have a different history kind of developed. I worked with Shiism on the Iranian side to see how that worked. And that's a blend to me of Zoroastrian principles and Islamic principles coming out as a different religion now, as Shiism. And on the Tajik side, I decided to investigate the situation of Tajikistan after the Soviet invasion, and I wanted to see what the impact of Soviet rule on Muslim Tajiks was and how their identity could have changed. That's how I got involved in the study of Tajikistan. And, of course, the history of the civil war in Tajikistan goes some 30 years back in my research as I gathered information on all these and wrote the other three volumes before I got to this one.
Yeah, and so in the first chapter in your book, you actually talk quite at length about your first visit to Central Asia in the early 90s, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Right. And I guess I was kind of interested, like, first of all, what were the questions that brought you to Central Asia in the first place? I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear about your experiences at that time, what you saw, what you witnessed, and how those early experiences in the 90s, just after the collapse of the Soviet Union, maybe did anything surprise you? I'm wondering if that helps explain some of the trajectory of your later work, like those initial experiences in Central Asia.
Well, my first trip was about 10 days, so not very long. I was invited by the Academy of Sciences, and there was a Tajik director, Margarita Kasimova, who came to Minneapolis, and we talked about Tajikistan. I really knew very little at that time about Tajikistan. And she said, well, I have a book called The Black Tulip, which deals with the Iranian Revolution. And she said that we will be willing to ask you to come to Tajikistan to see how the Tajiks live. Would you want something like that? I said, of course. But I didn't really think that that would come to anything, but it did. And some 6 months later, the Academy sent me an invitation for 10 days to go to Tajikistan, which I did. And there I was invited actually by the Kino Studio and not by the Academy, through the Academy. So when I got there, the Kino Studio people took over, and I didn't know quite why, because everybody else was there, academicians in the Academy going to meetings, and I was being taken around by the Kino Studio people, worried about what's going on, and telling them, this is why I came. They said, no, that's not what you came here. We invited you, and they did the invitation. That's all. They have nothing to do with you. Anyway, they took me everywhere, very hospitable people, and they had some movies and things that they had they wanted me to look at, especially on the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi. So I got involved in that and did some work with the Academy as well and returned. Then I thought I should probably have a project on Sadruddin Aini, who actually kind of has covered everything from early times of the Soviet Union, actually the Emirate of Bukhara, to be exact, all the way to the 50s. And I thought maybe I should work with his work to see what he tells me the transition was like. So I asked IREX for funding, and they accepted. And my wife and I then went to Tajikistan for 1 year. Now, the thing is that when I was in Tajikistan earlier, everything was great. It was Soviet Tajikistan, everything in place. Everybody happy to discuss Islam and whatever I wanted. And I thought that would be the best place actually to go and find what they have. But what happens then, of course, they were in the middle of, or beginning actually, of the civil war. And nobody wanted to talk about Islam. Nobody wanted to have anything to do with things that have happened. And I was surprised from just the airport on, as I looked at the streets and changes in the streets and all these people with guns all around, I was wondering if it's a safe place that I have brought my wife here. In any event...
Can you remind us when did you receive the IREX grant? And so what year are you talking about?
1993. And we got there about April 1993.
Okay.
Wow. So eventually we got an apartment settled, and I found that I can ask people I know now for books from their private libraries on INI to study while I sit here and really cannot even talk to people. Mm. Actually, we couldn't go out of the apartment. Mm-hmm. Between 10 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon is the time that was allowed at that time to be in Dushanbe around. Other than that, back in the apartment until tomorrow. So that's the situation that we had there for some 6 months. It was like that. And therefore, my study of Islam had to be pushed back a little bit, and my study of Aini came forth, and I learned a great deal about Aini's life, work, and those he knew, how Tajiks work. And then gradually I could talk to people here and there about the Islamic aspect of the Soviet life in Tajikistan and go on. The difficulty for us that stands out was when in August, around August, everything was going great. And then suddenly there were things we couldn't find anymore. Meat or, I don't know, things that you get, potatoes and carrots and so forth. And that it got to a point by December that we couldn't find anything. We go to the market, everything is closed. We go back to the apartment, we have nothing to eat. And then I talked to people, and a Tajik family kind of took us in. And we stayed with them until February when we came back to home to Minneapolis. So that's what stands out for me, is the difficulty that we had in December when we couldn't find anything. The apartment we were was on the 11th floor of the high rises. It didn't have any elevator working. It had elevators, but they did not work. So we had to go back and forth 11 stairs every day just to be out at 10 and be back by 3. Very, very difficult. And then food situation came up. First, people started to help us by knowing people and buying things like oil and so forth. And the time came that they said, we can't find anymore. Sorry. And then they helped us the other way.
Yeah, it sounds like, of course, this would sit with you for quite some time. And I think, it's a very tragic but probably also fascinating time to be in Tajikistan. And if you don't mind me asking, under what conditions did you leave the country in? So you said February of 1994. Were there any difficulties leaving?
No conditions. Everything was fine. We left
Okay. So things had kind of calmed down at least in Dushanbe by that time.
Yeah, after about 6 months or so, Rahmanov took over and things started to shape up, but no problem.
And have you visited, and I assume you visited Tajikistan since 1994?
Yeah, I have visited Tajikistan about 12 or 13 times.
Wow.
So every two or three years, I travel there to find out exactly what these people that I'm interested in are doing. Are they still alive? Are they not there? Talk to people about the war, talk to people about the situation at the time. So, you know, I've been in touch, kind of gathering notes, but not writing yet.
Now, you know, I should congratulate you on the publication of this book, because this is obviously a topic that's been with you for some time. And I'm curious, when did you realize that you wanted to, or that you had the aspiration to actually write a history of the Civil War? It's a pretty big undertaking.
The history of the Civil War, actually, I had an idea to write something about the Third Force in Tajikistan, which I was trying to find out information on, and I could not. Then I decided maybe I write a volume on Rahmanov and how he got to be president. I talked to him. He agreed to help me. But when I went actually for help, they wanted to know who would be involved, and I should submit every chapter that I write to them to look at and so forth. I said, well, we don't do things like that. We just investigate whatever it is we write. We cannot, there's no verification. If there is one, that's me. So I kind of decided not to pursue that. And Ken Jayev had sent me his three volumes with a note kind of telling me that if you don't work on this, nobody else would. And I hope that you will help me get my word out. And, of course, I was working on these other volumes at the time. And I was just, I read his materials, took notes, and put them aside until I was finished with the other volumes on identity that I talked about. Then eventually I decided to write the volume with his perspective. Now, whether that's the right perspective or not, I really am not interested. I just wanted to show what his perspective, how he saw himself in the Civil War, and he saw others in the Civil War, including Rahman, including Rahman's assistants and everyone else. And that's what I basically tried to do, to show what his effort was, where he went wrong, where he went right. And in the long run, whether the Tajiks made the right choice or not.
Yeah, and I think hopefully we'll kind of come back to this figure, Sepharli Kenjayev, who features prominently in a couple of chapters of the book. And I know, as you mentioned, a lot of your work was based on his recollections about the war. But I was wondering if we could kind of step back a little bit and talk about the bigger picture, because you have a chapter on, so your first chapter, you talk about your experiences in the 90s and kind of your, how you became familiar with Tajikistan. And then you give us a history in the second chapter, I think, a history of the Emirate of Bukhara, so the pre-Soviet period. And then you have a chapter of on Sovietization. And I'm curious, like, how you see these older historical periods, both in the 19th century and you know, the majority of the 20th century, how do they, do you see, like, can we trace the history of the Civil War or the causes of the Civil War back through those early historical periods?
Ideologically, we can. Usually people want to relate people to like from the 1970s to 1920s. That's how I see it. But ideologically, the battle, if you like, the conflict between the Muslims and the communists begins in the Emirate of Bukhara. And there were no communists yet, but the idea was there. And it develops gradually in southern Tajikistan and surfaces in the 1970s. And in that sense, there is a major relationship. I've tried very hard to develop that through lives of various people as the two sides developed Tajikistan, one side in southern Tajikistan developing Islamic schools, Islamic way of life, preaching that kind of thing. The other ones in the Gurbanchepa region are working very hard on cotton fields, working very hard on getting water to wastelands, what did communists usually do, and developed that area wonderfully. So at the end, we had an Islamic setup in schools and understanding and ideology developed, and we had an industry developed very wonderfully under communists with their atheistic ideas, and the two were as they had been against each other. So in that sense, it's the same story ideologically right through now.
And so if we kind of move forward, one thing I notice in a couple of the interviews you had in the book, several people referred, at the time in the early 90s, referred to glasnost and perestroika, so these late 80s kind of dual Gorbachev reforms that sought to kind of bring some reforms to the Soviet Union. A lot of people pointed to those as the reason for why tensions had built up in Tajikistan. And I'm just curious, do you think that still holds true today? Is that like a common belief from what you can see among Tajiks that the collapse of the Soviet Union and those attempted reforms, some might even say hasty reforms, actually led directly to the civil war?
Perestroika means restructuring. And in that sense, Tajiks were very happy, most of them, because they were no longer under the rules of the Soviet Union, could develop their republic, either Islamic or European, the way they wanted. Glasnost, meaning openness, gives them the ability to have their own media, to create parties, and to move their ideas the way, again, they want it. So in that sense, it opens the way for the Tajiks. Now, whether they understood exactly what those things mean or not is what the outcome was. But glasnost and perestroika kind of dissolved that imposition of authority that existed. And automatically then Tajiks felt free, and they thought they did not understand freedom in the sense of democracy and law and order. They understood as freedom, what you want to do, go ahead and do it, it's fine. In that sense, then gradually they started to go in different directions, and then the Islamists were very powerful, pulled things in one direction, and of course the Soviets were more powerful than that, pulled in the other direction, and the country then started to fall apart. So there were many factors involved. And I would say glasnost and perestroika started and ignited the Tajik civil war, but it was not the cause of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you
want. Right. So they kind of created, brought these tensions that, as you're saying, existed beforehand to the forefront.
Right.
Go ahead.
Let me give you some of the reasons that they were so unhappy with the system. Actually, they were unhappy with the nomenclatura and the cadre systems, this being the supervisors at the union level and specialists at the state level who managed everything, the lives of Tajiks in general, whether at kolkhoz level, whether at family level, whether at individual level. So they were not happy with that. For example, they sent a cadre from Moscow. That person would bring another person with, like as a first secretary or as an assistant. And this person chooses people that he knows in Tajikistan who can do things. And they choose the ones that they know. And that leaves most of the Tajiks out of job, out of school, and that kind of thing. So they were not happy with this system of nomenclatura. They were not happy as far as nationalism is concerned because they felt, again, that their national interest is in their traditional Iranian Tajik way of life, and they are being denied. They could not have their Nowruz, they could not read the Shahnameh, they could not do a lot of things that they normally would like to do. Instead, they had to go into classes of atheism, classes into things that were not really Islamic the way they wanted, or they had to go away. So they were kind of two nationalities in one. Regionalism was another thing. Like the Soviets, when they came to Tajikistan, they chose the northern people and then preferred them, giving jobs, responsibilities, and so forth, over southern people. And these two parts of Tajikistan, because of the mountains in between, are quite separate. You can have almost two Tajikistans. So the rulership, the power was in the north. Everybody in the south, in the cotton fields, are working as they wished. And they did what Moscow wished. So there was also this clash between north and south created by the Soviets, but in Tajikistan nevertheless. So that would be regionalism. And they built a lot of things that even in Tajikistan, in places like Gurgantepe, while I didn't pay much attention to Kulab, and that put the Kulabis and the Gurgantepe people against each other, that kind of thing. And of course, ideology, as I've been saying, was a major thing, suppressing Shiite Sharia Islam and imposing atheistic and communistic ways of life was something that Basmachis didn't want, was something that the Jadids, most of them after they even came into the Soviet Union and worked for the Soviet Union, did not want. So those are, to me, the major issues that I saw early in my work with Tajikistan that are kind of brewing into something eventually, which is not good. But then the openness that came and the ability to restructure gave them the possibility to do what they had planned to do from day one.
And so I want to kind of dive more deeply into the events that kind of, as we move, as we see the collapse of the Soviet Union happening in Tajikistan, really things start to pick up in February of 1990. So well before you were there,
right.
And this mostly surrounds Kahor Mahkamov, who was the first secretary of the Communist Party of Tajikistan at the time, if I'm correct. And you know there are these events that happened in February of 1990, and this is the first kind of unrest that we see that eventually leads to. To a broader civil war. So I was wondering if, I think even for people who study the history of the Soviet Union and the Soviet collapse, maybe these events are not very well known. So I was wondering if you could kind of summarize like what the tensions in that specific moment were and how this tension actually gets us to expands into an actual civil war with several fronts and kind of factions split along these regional lines.
Okay, if we keep the Islamic and atheist in the background as a major mover, and then I can say that maybe Kenjayev, who was chosen by Nabiyev to be the head of the Supreme Soviet, is a person to look at. Now, Kenjayev brought the Minister of Interiors, his name was Mehmet Ayaz Nojavanov, to trial on embezzlement, and he televised the whole thing. Now, Nojavanov is from Badakhshan, and Kenjayev is from Hisar. In other words, one person from this region is accusing and showing everyone in the world that this Badakhshani has embezzled and has cars and houses and so forth at your expense. Now, the next morning after this trial, we have the Badakhshanis coming to the Supreme Soviet in a sit-in that lasts a long time, and they want Kenjayev out. And Nabiyev, who probably is the cause of the trial in the background, does not help Kenjayev and does not accept Nojavanov's resignation. And eventually the Islamists see this and they capitalize on that and talk Nabiyev into getting rid of Kenjayev, which he does, and Dustov, his assistant. So when Nabiyev loses these two people, he becomes pretty much a lonely figure in Tajikistan under the auspices of the Islamists. And eventually they forced him out of office at gunpoint. He was in the airport actually going to Khojand when this happened, and they forced him to resign. And Iskandarov comes to power, and the Government of National Reconciliation is formed at that time, which lasts for some 6 months, but rules only in the southern parts, partially, and not in the north. The northern people did not accept the government. But gradually then the elders get together in Khojand and decide that they should have a meeting, and in that meeting decide on a new constitution and form a constitutional government and the parliament and a new way of life for the Tajiks. So that's how the Government of National Reconstruction or Reconciliation came into being, and what Nabiyev's role was, what Kenjayev's role was, and what the Islamists.
And so this Government of National Reconciliation that's formed, how can we best understand this? Is this an attempt to bring different factions together under one, I guess, to share power? What was the goal of that?
The goal, the short goal was to make Tajikistan Islamic. The longer one was to create an Islamic republic like Afghanistan, like Iran in Tajikistan, and throw out Soviet rule and any other rule out. So long and short, a little bit different.
Okay. And so there's another figure that stands out prominently in your book that I wanted to bring up, which is the Qazi Qalqon, which is kind of like a religious leader, Hoji Akbar Turajan.
Right.
How does he figure in all of this?
He most of the time played on both sides. So he was with Nabiyev and with the Islamists, with Kenjayev and with the Islamists at the same time. And as a religious leader, he always said that he did not want to get himself involved in politics. But of course, politics, half of it was ideology, and he was in the middle of that. But people didn't recognize that. So they paid great attention to him. He tried to, not tried, but he tried, changed everyone that Soviets had put in place in the mosques, out in all the mosques in the republics except for Kulab, and changed them to his choices. And in that sense, he had a major grip for a while on Tajikistan and on Tajik politics. But he does not come very high, in fact, when you think about it. He was limited by ideology and by the people that that followed him, not a very large following.
And so we see this, we see the way that this government of national reconciliation is formed. How does the civil war progress from that point? Because I see that, okay, so once this government is formed, it's not fully recognized within the country. You mentioned that up in the northern part of the country, they actually reject that government. Is this the basis on which the civil war becomes a full-blown war, or is there a more complex picture going on?
Now, this is almost, we could say, the culmination. And again, I should say Kenjayev had a major part in this, that when he was dismissed from the headship of the Supreme Soviet, he formed his own command in Hisar, and big organization, and eventually shot his way into Tajikistan, into Dushanbe, to take over. And he did not succeed because other commanders in the south had told him, we'll meet you at Butovsky Bridge on that day and we'll all march into Dushanbe. They didn't show up. There was Sangyak Safarov and others. Therefore, he didn't have by himself the power to take over, and he went to the Russians, and with their help, he tried to and succeeded, I think, in forcing the government of national reconciliation to accept a meeting in Khojand in which to decide the fate of the Tajiks without getting actually in war and getting a lot of people killed. And that is how the Khojand meeting is important and how it came to be.
And so I just want to take a step back now. And because earlier in the interview, you mentioned that one of your goals was to kind of understand the way that Rahmonov or Rahmon had come to power, and how, I guess, the basis of contemporary state building in Tajikistan, like how it emerged out of the war. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Rahmon's background and how this, basically how he came out winning the election in the 90s.
Rahmon originally was a kolkhoz head in Kula. Not very many people knew him. He was in one or two battles as commander. But in the Khojand meeting, he gave a resounding speech, and is very good in giving long speeches in how Tajikistan can be saved, what our role should be. And there, I think people started to look at him as the type of person that they wanted to rule Tajikistan. And they made him what was called Sardar Davlat, the leader of the government. And later on, he became president, and he is president until today. So not a very well-known figure in the early stages.
And I kind of want to turn the conversation a little bit, because one thing, so I'm thinking about writing a history of an event that happened, you know, relatively recently, and the challenges that kind of poses. And I was thinking one thing as I was reading the book. I know, for instance, that the book that Kenjayev actually shared with you played an important role in your writing of the book, as did some of the interviews that you were able to do in 93.
Right.
And I was just curious if you could, I mean, are there any other major sources that you found useful? Because I do see other types of memoirs cited throughout. And particularly, did you face any challenges while writing this kind of history, given the relatively recent nature of those events and like the sources that were available to you?
Well, the sources that I used were mostly Tajik and those who had actually participated in some of the meetings and written about them. That's one source. The sources that are in English are mostly written about the Civil War, again, through interviews and discussions with people there, but do not have the background. And that's what I thought was necessary to write a history that shows in gradual development from the beginning of the conflict to the conflict that we have. And the conflict we have today, or we had, I should say, was the end of that. So what caused it, how it developed, and that's, I think, what is different, the difference between things that are now going as history of civil war in Tajikistan and what I have. Other than that, the interviews are the same. They have talked to the same people. Some of them have read Kenjayev, for example, or have had someone read Kenjayev for them and interpreted it. But it's a different thing to live with people and to talk to them and then to read what they have and assess it for yourself, where this person stands, not who said how, but this commander who makes this decision at this point to do this to the soldiers, is that a correct decision? And you find that that maybe is right or that he's not. Kenjayev was a lawyer and he happened to become a commander. Now, when they asked him, for example, to come to the Potovsky Bridge and will be there, well, any commander would think about it 10 times, whether they would be there or not, that I take everyone to Dushanbe and put them in jeopardy. But he accepted and he came, and that's what happened to him.
Perfect. So, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That's really interesting. And I hope that we continue to see, it's a relatively understudied topic. And so I wanted to thank you again for writing this book, because I think we need more material on this very important event, actually. I think there's a lot of discussion about the collapse of the Soviet Union being, some people say a relatively peaceful event, and I feel like they're missing a lot of the picture. I mean, there are so many places where the transition was very difficult, and Tajikistan is certainly one of those places. So I think this is a really important study, and I hope that others will find it useful for understanding the ways in which the unraveling of the Soviet system kind of vibrated throughout the former Soviet Union.
I hope so too.
And so in that kind of train of thought, I actually want to turn to the way that you end the book, which I read somewhat positively, or I guess we can call it a cautionary tale. So you write that democracy demands that every Tajikistani should be given a meaningful role in the administration of the state. You continue by saying that deviations from the democratic ideal of the Hujan representatives is likely to place Tajik leaders in the same spot where the Soviet Tajik leaders found themselves in the 1970s and 1980s. And I was wondering if, and this is kind of nearing the end of our discussion, but I was wondering if you could explain what you meant by this statement, especially the second part where you talk about the position that Soviet Tajik leaders found themselves in the 70s and 80s. What problems in representation in government on the part of different localities still exists? And how do you think Tajikistan will deal with this as they continue to build their state and hopefully find a good solution to some of these problems?
Well, the major problem that that I see in Tajikistan today is nepotism. Now, that is what the Soviets used to divide people and to force them to work. In the sense that Rahman is working very hard for the Tajiks, he should be appreciated greatly. But in that, he gets all the donations from outside and distributes them in the same way that we were talking about the nomenclatura and the cadres, as if we are back in the Soviet Union and everyone is, again, working for the same master without having any say, and the cadres choose the ones that they want fed and those who are meritorious. In that sense, I think they are not going the right way, and the way that Khojand people wanted it really was a democratic way of life for the Tajiks in which everybody got a fair shake. But the way I see it, and I see it from a distance, from a distance and from what is being reported more and more, that the allocations are not fair. And the family of the president is in charge of everything. And that is what I meant, that we are where we were and not where we were scheduled to be.
Yeah, thank you. And once again, I wanted to thank you for agreeing to sit down and have this conversation. I think it's a really important topic, and I found I certainly learned a lot from reading your book, and I hope to continue to kind of engage with these topics. So thanks again for agreeing to sit down with us. And we're kind of nearing the end of our time today, but as is custom, I want to ask, are there any future projects that you have in mind right now, or any current projects that you've already started that you'd like to share with us?
Well, right now I'm writing an article on Zoroastrianism, the religion of ancient Iran, and one on the relationship between Tajik and Iranian literature over the centuries until the end of the Soviet Union, and also getting materials for post-Soviet war Tajik identity. See where I get? I don't know.
Great. Those all sound like fascinating projects, especially for us who are interested in kind of Persian identity and the history of Persian-speaking people. So should that book on Tajik, post-Soviet Tajik identity, manifest into a book, we'd love to have you back on the program to talk about that. So thank you again, Dr. Bashiri, for agreeing to talk with us. For our listeners, if you want to check out this book, and I highly recommend it, you'll want to look for The History of the Civil War in Tajikistan by Iraj Bashiri, and that's published this year, 2020, by Academic Studies Press. So thanks again, Iraj.
Surely. Thank you for taking the time.